From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Two actors on today's Fresh Air. We talk with Barbara Hershey, the star of A World Apart, Beaches, and Hannah and Her Sisters. And John Mahoney tells us why at the age of 37, he gave up a secure but boring job and took up acting. He's since appeared in the films Eight Men Out, Moonstruck, Betrayed, and Say Anything. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews Markers, journalist Sidney Zion's new novel of politics and the underworld. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Anti-independence forces protested today in Estonia and Latvia. Pro-Soviet demonstrators in Estonia briefly tore the Republic's flag from the top of the Parliament building and raised the Soviet hammer and sickle flag in its place. They were reportedly dispersed by a far greater number of pro-independence demonstrators. In Latvia, thousands of Soviet soldiers tried to break into the Latvian legislature during demonstrations against the Republic's declaration of independence. Latvian officials say they were held in check by local militia units. President Bush today opened a budget summit with a bipartisan group of congressional leaders to reach an agreement that will reduce the deficit and avoid automatic spending cuts. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
In opening the meeting, which lasted for 1 hour and 40 minutes, President Bush conceded that while there is no immediate crisis, economic growth is not as strong and secure as it should be. Today's focus was the economic assumptions behind the deficit. The administration admits that its current projections are now drastically worse than those of 3 months ago, due in large part to the growing cost of the savings and loan industry bailout. House Speaker Tom Foley.
Well, it's important for us, before we set out to attempt to resolve problems, to know rather thoroughly the extent and nature of the problem.
The next meeting is scheduled for Thursday on Capitol Hill. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
The U.S. Secretary of State was shown on Soviet television tonight, smiling as he got off a plane in Moscow. James Baker's in the Soviet capital to smooth the way for the superpower summit in Washington at the end of May. He arrives as the Soviet leader is absorbed in a long list of domestic problems. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Moscow.
James Baker begins his rounds of meetings with Soviet officials tomorrow. His task is to wrap up the last-minute details of the superpowers summit that may lead to a treaty on arms reduction to be signed in Washington. Baker's most important meeting comes at the end of the trip when he meets with the Soviet president, Mikhail Gorbachev. It's clear that Gorbachev is the man who can deliver, but Baker's team is putting out a pessimistic assessment. Gorbachev is deeply involved with domestic problems, from the moves on Baltic independence to the economic crisis. Baker flies home at the end of the week. Gorbachev arrives in Washington at the end of May. His first stop in the West is in Canada. Reports today say he'll also travel to Minnesota and California. In Moscow, this is Deborah Amos.
A presidential commission said today that the United States should consider military strikes or covert operations against terrorist groups that attack passenger aircraft. The recommendations came in a report from the 7-member panel that investigated the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost a point to close at 2,822.45. Declines led advances 4-3 in active trading. This is NPR News. The National Labor Relations Board has decided to intervene in the Greyhound bus strike. The board said today that it would file an unfair labor practice complaint against Greyhound and seek a nationwide injunction against misconduct by the union. Both the union and the company had filed complaints against each other with the NLRB, alleging misconduct and violation of labor law. The board said its general counsel found merit in the union's charges that the company went ahead and put its own bargaining proposals into effect before talks with the union had reached an impasse. The Labor Relations Board said it also found that the union had engaged in violence and picket line misconduct. A strike by Nicaragua's public sector employees, now in its fifth day, is spreading and has forced a showdown between President Violeta Chamorro's new government and supporters of the Sandinista Party. Robert Meyerowitz has this report from Managua.
Striking government ministry employees have only become more intransigent one day after the new Minister of Labor declared that their strike was illegal and ordered them back to work within 24 hours. Employees of most government ministries workplaces and have refused to let government officials enter. They say they want a 200% pay increase to offset recent monetary devaluations, but central bank president Francisco Mayorga says that that's not the real issue, that the real issues are political. It's unclear what the government's next step is going to be, but with both the bank director and the Minister of Labor declaring that there is nothing to negotiate with the strikers and mixed success in using the police to reopen the ministries, this may only leave the option of calling out the army to deal with the strikers. For National Public Radio, I'm Robert Meyerowitz in Managua.
The number of unemployed workers in East Germany grew to more than 100,000 last month. That's a jobless rate three times as high as it was in March. East Germany's newly founded Association for the Unemployed says that unemployment has soared as formerly state-run industries shut down or restructure themselves. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Barbara Hershey has starred in the films Hannah and Her Sisters, Tin Men, Shy People, A World Apart, and Beaches. She won a Best Actress Award an unprecedented 2 years in a row at the Cannes Film Festival. But there was a period in her career when she had a hard time being taken seriously in Hollywood. Some say it's because she had an image problem. In the early 70s, on the set of her film Last Summer, a trained bird died during one of the scenes. Hershey said she felt the soul of the bird merge with hers, so she changed her last name to Siegel. Hershey doesn't like to talk to the press about the Siegel period of her life. Barbara Hershey is starring in the forthcoming adaptation of the Maria Vargas Llosa novel Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter. But you can also see her next Tuesday evening on CBS in a made-for-TV movie called Killing in a Small Town. It's based on the true story of a Texas housewife who murdered her neighbor with 41 blows from an axe and was acquitted on grounds of self-defense. Brian Dennehy plays her lawyer. Barbara Hershey rarely takes parts on TV, but she was intrigued by the role of the repressed housewife committing an axe murder in self-defense.
She registered in a contradictory sense, which is the best way to register with me, I think, because I find the contradictions in all of us the most interesting part of us. And it was so untypical for TV, even for a film, to tell you the truth, to find a character this complex and a story this so sort of profoundly unglib. It didn't seem to have an answer to what it was showing. It was just showing it in this very kind of deep, disturbing way that I felt it was a totally unique thing. And yes, I had a lot of conflicting feelings about the character.
What were those conflicting feelings?
Well, one thing is, Was she guilty? Was she not guilty? Is she a good person? Is she a bad person? Is she? Do I like her? She was treated so badly by the townspeople. Can I identify with the parts of her life that she had problems with? Am I like her? Does that scare me?
Did you find anything that frightened you about yourself in doing the role?
Well, I find, first of all, I think this piece is about all of us. I don't think this piece, it is about this specific woman, but it truly is about the dark side of all of us. This woman, while she did kill this other woman and hit her 41 times, even with the axe, she is not insane. And I think that's the intriguing and important part of the story. The second thing that was about to me was that this is brought about, this story is about people who are repressed in this very common way that a lot of us are repressed by what I call the sweet cautions, the what will the neighbors think kind of cautions, or don't cry, or hold it in, or be strong, or be happy, or whatever it is that we're taught from birth. And a lot of violence comes out of this repression. And it's a kind of repression that we've all dealt with. And that's one of the things I liked about it, was it really was about all of us.
You play your character as someone who's dimmed her feelings, someone who can't really allow herself to feel a lot. Is that hard to do in a performance? I mean, for instance, a lot of times actors will rely on, you know, certain gestures and flourishes to convey a sense of the character. But in this, you have to shut down a little bit.
Yeah. Well, the important thing, I think, in all of that is to, one might have the tendency to just do nothing. But what you have to do is you have to have it all there and then cover it and then repress it. And that's difficult. You can't just walk around with a blank expression on your face. You have to find what's under it and then cover it.
How do you do that exactly? Well, I mean, how do you act? But for instance, what did you put yourself through in preparing for this to get a sense of what those emotions were and then to put a cap on them?
Well, first, because this is based on a real woman, I did a lot of the research that one does in that kind of case. I talked to the real woman. I talked to the lawyers who they were actually there while we were doing the trial. I read transcripts of the trial, which was her testimony made my hair stand on end. I read all the newspaper articles that were out. I saw the news footage of her. All of that kind of stuff, which is normal, I think, when you pay someone. But the bigger, deeper work really had to do with finding the part in me that could do such a thing. And that just came by asking those questions and just trying to deal honestly with it. The director did a wonderful thing. He's a wonderful director named Stephen Gyllenhaal. And before filming, he sent me a note saying, you can choose truth or you can choose comfort, but you can't have both of them. Guess which one I want both of you to have. And that sort of became our motto throughout. We really went for it. And it meant that we had nightmares, and it meant that we really went through a lot. But I think it shows in the film.
There are certain physical props you need for this role. You have large, really plain glasses, a kind of really old-fashioned-looking hairdo that looks like it was with some kind of at-home permanent.
You know,
it didn't turn out all that well.
Right.
Is it helpful to you when you're going to be wearing, you know, funny hair? And I mean, you know, the kind of hair you wouldn't wear and plain glasses. Is it helpful to stand in front of the mirror a lot and see what you look like to get a sense of who this person is physically?
I didn't stand in front of the mirror a lot. That's part of the fun of acting is that stuff, but at the same time, it's more than just putting on a hat. You find yourself sitting differently and moving differently and feeling differently, and there's a vocabulary of body language that comes out that isn't just really putting on glasses or a hat, but all of that helps. I just do everything I can from the inside out and the outside in to make me feel like the character.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by that is to find the part of me that is the character and until there's really no difference.
You're a very attractive actress. When you're playing someone who's plain, like the woman in A Killing in a Small Town, what do you do to yourself so that you look plain? Is it just a question of not putting on makeup?
Yeah. It's amazing what a hairdo can do. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing what glasses can do and not putting on makeup. I would make the crew laugh by saying how horrified I was that this took 15 minutes to make me look like this, because I wish it was a 3-hour makeup that made me look like that. It actually was very simple. Sometimes it's a little more complicated. It's very liberating to do it, though, because really, then you just feel like the character, and there's an unselfconsciousness in it that I really enjoy. Not that I want to play every role like that, but when it happens, I find it very liberating. You know, you don't have to think about your nose being shiny or something.
Right. Does it ever strike you as ironic that it's often beautiful actresses like yourself who get cast even in plain roles, and so many plain actresses you end up getting shut out altogether? Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, no, don't make me feel bad.
Oh, no. I didn't mean that to take anything away from you. It's just,
I just think that all the barriers that can be broken down should, that we're each other. And if I can play someone, you know, I don't feel like it's like taking your glasses off and shaking your hair down and suddenly you're beautiful or something. I think if you can deeply play someone who's plain and no matter what you look like, then that's good. You know, that's we should all play each other, right? I don't think of it in terms of taking jobs away from people.
Oh, and that's not the way I meant it.
Oh, good.
Either.
But it's true, you know. I mean, I don't think about it, but when I get a role, I mean, it means 10 people don't. So that is part of it. That is true.
You're in your early 40s now, and I think for some actresses in their 40s, they find that there are suddenly fewer roles available to them because they're no longer the young leading lady. It's really been the opposite with you. It seems like the older you get, the more interesting the parts are, the more of them there.
Yeah.
What do you account for that?
Well, when I'm feeling good, I agree with you. And then when I'm feeling bad, I'm thinking, where are the roles? They certainly are better roles, and I certainly have more capacity as a human being to play a bigger variety and deeper roles. But there's still very few women's roles. I mean, my agent last week said he read 10 scripts and they were all men. It's very difficult to find them. And out of the few, how many of them are good? So you have to really sit a lot and have a lot of faith that the good ones are coming. It's difficult. It's very difficult. There's not that much.
How has the kind of role that you've been offered over the years changed?
It's hard to say because each role is different, and then I've changed. So it's really hard to say. The one thing I concentrated on always my whole life was to play a variety of roles, and that's the one thing I can say with any certainty is that I have played a variety of roles. I've played in big-budget movies and little-budget movies, and I've played very serious things and very comedic things. So I don't know. I can't see it as a whole. In a funny way, I think people like you might have a better perspective on me. It's very hard when you're in the middle of it to look at yourself.
My guest is actress Barbara Hershey, and her movie Killing in a Small Town will be broadcast on CBS next Tuesday. You've credited Hannah and Her Sisters, the Woody Allen movie, as being a movie that helped turn around your career. How did you get the part?
It was one of those great experiences like an actor dreams of all your life after years of auditioning and years of rejection and years of encouragement. But I walked in and Woody said, here, if you like it, you have it. So I didn't have to read. I didn't have to audition. It seemed like a dream. And I had just moved to New York and I had no money and I had hardly any friends in New York. And it couldn't have happened at a more wonderful time for me. So it was a real gift, that film.
Had you been friends or anything? Did he just know you from your movies?
He'd know me from my movies. I'd bumped into him once, so how do you do, that kind of thing. But no, I didn't know him at all. No, he knew me from film, and that was it.
What did he tell you about your character?
He didn't say much. He doesn't tend to talk too much about the characters, but his genius is his writing. I think he's one of the great prolific true geniuses in film in America who actually expresses himself with film, which is so hard to do, let alone to be allowed to express yourself with film. And so his characters are so well written that you don't really have to ask a lot of questions. He'd make fun of my questions, actually.
Such as? Like, what kind of question would he make fun of?
I don't remember the specific question, but he said that I always asked a lot of questions, and then he finally just started answering anything just to satisfy me, and he would tease me about it until I stopped doing it. But that's my tendency. I like having a dialogue with directors, and it isn't that I don't know the answers, but I'm curious about their answers. I like working with people. I think that's part of the joy, when it works anyway, in filmmaking, is it is a conglomeration of people, not too many, but the director and the writer or the fellow actor, or those chosen at the moment. But that's part of the joy of it, is sometimes you're taken somewhere where you might not ordinarily go on your own. But he didn't like to talk too much. He just wasn't interested in that, whereas someone like Scorsese will talk to you forever.
Well, Scorsese, now you made two movies with Scorsese. The first was one of his first movies, Boxcar Bertha. That was, I think,
right.
72. And the other was Last Temptation of Christ. Back in the early 70s when you were making Boxcar Bertha together, did you have a sense of, like, what an inspired director he was going to become?
Well, it was funny. I didn't think in those terms, but I sure did notice. We shot Boxcar Bertha, which I don't know if you ever saw it, but it's, I think, terribly crippled by AIP sex and violence and all that, but the heart of it is so charming, and all that is Marty. We were like the characters in The Wizard of Oz. We were wonderful characters, and that was all Marty's doing, and his encouragement and his enthusiasm. And we shot it in 4 weeks, and I often do not use the word fun as an adjective to describe movie making, but it really was fun. And it was insane. It was crazy. And we weren't making the movie they wanted us to make, but he was into it. And we would improvise. And even in a four-week schedule, it was some kind of ecstasy I'd never experienced before with the director.
So American International Pictures wanted, like, an exploitation film, and you were trying to do a different kind of movie?
They wanted Bloody Mama. They wanted me to stand there with guns and be Boxcar Bertha. And we made it about dumb people who bump into each other and don't quite understand why they're doing what they're doing, but they all have their little individual reasons. And it was much more real and charming and original than I think they understood at the time or were interested in.
No, I think it was during the making of Boxcar Bertha that you gave Scorsese a copy of the Kazantzakis novel, The Last Temptation of Christ.
I actually didn't give him a copy, but I told him about the book because at that time in my life, and since, it's my favorite book. And I knew, first of all, how talented he was. I saw that pretty fast. But also, as I got to know him, I started learning about his religious leanings, which were very extreme and unconventional, yet very traditional in lots of ways. And so I said, you should read this book and you should make it into a movie. And he told me, I said, you should also cast me as Mary Magdalene, which I don't remember saying, but it sounds like me. Not thinking, of course, you say things like that, not thinking someone would go off and do that. But he did.
When did you find out that he was serious about making it into a movie?
Years later, I read it in the trades that he was making The Last Temptation of Christ with Chardoff and Winkler were producing it. And I screamed out loud. I remember reading it, and I literally, a yell came out of my mouth. And I ran to the phone, and I called my agent. My hands were shaking, and I said, I have to try out. And I met with Marty, and I tried out for 3 months, three different auditions, taped and tested and all that. And Marty told me later that the reason he made me try out so hard was because he wanted to make sure he wasn't giving it to me for any obligatory reason, because I turned him on to the book, but because truly I was the best for the part, which in learning that, I was glad he did put me through it, because I wouldn't want the other either. So that's how. And then, of course, it got canceled, but that's a whole different story.
Had you expected that the final movie would be this just very New York contemporary version of the Bible?
It surprised me. While we were making it, I understood his concept that way because he wanted it to feel like it really happened. And the people of that area, since we weren't speaking the language truly, would have various dialects of various areas of that they. That was his idea behind it. But Marty's ears are New York ears, and I think to his ears it wasn't as extreme as it sounded to the rest of us. No, I didn't imagine it that way, but I didn't mind it either. I understood what he was doing with it that way.
My guest is actress Barbara Hershey, and she's starring in a made-for-TV movie called A Killing in a Small Town, which will be broadcast next Tuesday on CBS. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Actress Barbara Hershey is my guest. Her recent movies include Beaches, The Last Temptation of Christ, A World Apart, Shy People, and Tin Men. She's co-starring in a made-for-TV movie called Killing in a Small Town, which will be broadcast next Tuesday night on CBS. You grew up in Hollywood, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Were you part of a Hollywood family at all?
No. I was, as a matter of fact, it's sort of funny that I was raised in Hollywood because I knew nobody in show business. And I knew about a three-block radius from my house, so it was sort of like being raised in a small town.
What'd your parents do?
My father was a handicapper at the Racing Form, wrote a column at the Racing Form, which was a horse racing newspaper in Los Angeles. He was from New York originally.
Was he a gambler himself?
Mm-hmm.
Did that cause problems in the family?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He gambled away a lot of the family money?
What little we had, sure, that happened. But it wasn't... you know, a tragedy or anything. It was just a part of his life that sometimes met with my mother's disapproval.
Did he take you to the races?
Occasionally. Occasionally. It was fun to see him there because he was so enthusiastic about it, and he was one of these people who was wonderful with numbers. He could add up numbers very quickly, and it was sort of his arena, sort of the world he was born to be in. So it was nice to see him in that enthusiastic.
When you were young and you wanted to act, was that out of a desire to, you know, dress up in costumes, or was there something other than that going on inside you when you were young?
I think it was all of that, but I think there was something definitely stronger, and I think it, strangely enough, relates to what we were talking about earlier about the sweet cautions and the repression that is in our society that comes from holding things back, not expressing anger. I wasn't allowed in my household to really contradict or to express anger, and I'd go into the backyard and I'd act out the Wicked Witch. I had this wonderful world of release, And it made my childhood actually quite happy. But I often say that I'm an actor because of repression, really. It was a need to get it out. And it was also based on a lot of joy. I really think it was sincerely great training, my backyard. It was imaginative and joyful, and there it came from a need.
You got your first professional job, I think, through doing a play at Hollywood High and having an agency. Was that the story?
Sort of. It's close enough.
So what was the first role you got?
The very first role was I played Sally Field's girlfriend in an episode of Gidget on television.
Well, I know Sally Field, it took her years to get out of the Gidget typecasting. Did you ever have a problem with that when you were getting started because of the early TV work that you did?
No, I never was identified too much with one character. I did do a series, but it wasn't successful, much probably to my good, because I do think that's a trap. But it was great training.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I ever had that problem. I think the bigger problem was the transition from girl to woman, which a lot of kids, when they start acting kind of young, have difficulty with.
How did you have difficulty with it?
Well, you mature faster than people's perceptions of you do. And when you're already, you know, 22, 23, they're still interested in casting you as a teenager, especially if you look young, which I did. So finally, you know, you're way ahead of them. And to get them to realize that you're a woman now takes some doing sometimes when they have it set in their head that you're a teenager.
What was the first movie where you felt like you were your age and your maturity?
The Stuntman. The Stuntman, I felt, was a big leap in that direction, where I was an ingenue, but I wasn't a kid. And I think that was a big turning point for me.
Mm-hmm. Your birth name was Herzstein?
Yeah.
Who changed it for you?
A Jewish agent who thought it was too Jewish sounding, which really makes me laugh, way back then. And at first I hated Hershey, but I grew to like it fine.
Was that supposed to have some kind of coy resonance because of, like, sweet chocolate or something?
I hope not. That's how I associated it at first, and I really despised it at first. And then after a while, it became a name to me.
I know, as an interviewer, that there's a part of your life that you're really not anxious to talk about, which is fine and is your prerogative. But I was wondering if you felt over the years that you had been really betrayed or burned by the press, that you're, you know, that cautious about discussing a part of your life.
Oh, I'm just bored with it. I'm bored with discussing the past to the point of nausea. I can't tell you how boring it is.
Is it really boredom, though? Because I think everybody who's in the public light has to rehash the past so much that you
but one little
just
section
accept it.
No, but not one little section of your life over and over again. They just want to talk about that one little section. So I've just gotten to the point where I say no. You know, I really don't want to talk about it anymore. It's boredom, finally.
Mm-hmm. How much did that affect your career when you weren't getting the roles you wanted?
I don't know.
Is it the kind of thing you never can really know?
I don't know. It's hard. Like I said, it's hard for me to have an overview.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll know later.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for
talking with us.
And Barbara Hershey is in a made-for-TV movie called Killing in a Small Town, which will be broadcast next Tuesday on CBS. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we'll have a concert with the new wave polka band Brave Combo. I hope you can join us.
People are strange. When you're a stranger, faces look ugly when you're alone.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Actor John Mahoney has appeared in the recent films 8 Men Out, Betrayed, Moonstruck, and Say Anything. And if you don't remember him from many earlier films, it's because he started late, at age 37. Coming up, John Mahoney on giving up a boring career to take up acting and going on to work with such directors as Roman Polanski, John Sayles, and Costa Gavras. Also, book critic John Leonard has a review of journalist Sidney Zion's new novel, Markers, about the connections between business, politics, and crime. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Parliament buildings in both Estonia and Latvia were attacked by anti-independence demonstrators today. Government officials in Estonia said that they considered the attack by some 5,000 people a coup attempt. After some 3 hours, thousands of Estonians responded to radio appeals by the president of that republic and forced the demonstrators to disperse. Earlier, about 2,000 Soviet soldiers and cadets stormed the Latvian parliament. Iraq has again denied that it is building a super gun. Iraqi Foreign Minister Parik Aziz today told reporters in Rome that 90 tons of metal components seized in Italy last week were intended for a petrochemical plant. NPR's Silvia Pagioli has more from Rome.
Similar cargoes of components for a suspected super gun have been seized recently in Britain, Greece, and Turkey. Aziz said reports that Iraq is building a super gun capable of firing nuclear or chemical weapons several hundred kilometers is a lie.
You know, this fabrication came in the midst of a campaign which was organized by the Israelis and those circles influenced by the Israelis.
The minister added that the campaign is directed at limiting Iraq's ability to buy advanced technology in Europe and that if it did have a super gun, it would show it to the world. The foreign minister held his press conference only a few hours after authorities in Frankfurt seized 17 containers of machine parts headed for Iraq. Police suspect they could form another segment of the supergun. In Rome, this is Silvia Poggioli.
In southeastern Texas, several hundred people have now moved to higher ground because of expected record flooding from the rain-swollen Trinity River. As many as 7,000 people may be forced from their homes by this weekend. Lance Smith of member station KUHF has more.
North Texas floodwaters from 2 weeks ago continue to flow down the Trinity River, destroying homes and farmland. The leading edge is expected to hit Liberty County later today. Emergency management officials say the rain-swollen Trinity River is expected to crest by the weekend. When that happens, about 20 subdivisions located along an area called the river bottom will have water in them. Officials here say the devastation from the upcoming flood will surpass two previous floods this century, and it could be the middle of June before many residents are able to return to their homes. As one official put it, we're hoping for the best and expecting the worst. For National Public Radio, I'm Lance Smith in Liberty County.
Soviet leader Gorbachev will visit Canada as well as the U.S. later on this month. According to officials in Canada, the Soviet leader will be in their country May 29th and 30th. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up less than a point to close at 2,822.45, volume 166 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. John Mahoney had just started acting in Chicago when he met John Malkovich, a founding member of the Steppenwolf Theater Company. Malkovich invited Mahoney to join the company. That was in the late 70s, and Mahoney has been acting ever since. He went to New York with the Steppenwolf production of Orphans and won a Tony Award for his role in John Gare's House of Blue Leaves. In the last few years, Mahoney has branched out into movies. In Moonstruck, he played the college professor who makes a play for Olympia Dukakis. In 8 Men Out, he was Kid Gleason, the manager of the Chicago White Sox, and in Say Anything, he played the father. He's currently appearing at the Goodman Theater in a production of Uncle Vanya, adapted by David Mamet. But acting wasn't Mahoney's first career. He was editing a medical journal when he switched careers, so I wanted to know what was covered in the journal.
Ophthalmology or cataract surgery or central supply, or it could be anything, virtually any aspect of of the healthcare system as it is within a hospital. And it's very, very boring, actually. I've tried to think of some way to make it more interesting, but it isn't, and it wasn't, which is a lot to do with why I don't do it anymore.
When did you know that you were really unhappy in this job?
Well, it wasn't anything that where you go home every night and bang your head against a wall and say, "Oh my God, I'm so unhappy." It was just an insidious thing. You just keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and gradually you realize that you're smoking an awful lot, and that you're drinking a little bit too much, and that you're sleeping very late whenever you can. And it wasn't until I started to do my new job, which was acting, that I looked back and realized the absolute depth of my depression while I was doing the editorial work.
It takes a lot of guts or a lot of despair to make a big change.
Exactly.
Like that, when you don't know what the outcome's going to be. Was there a pivot point, a moment where you said, okay, that's it, I'm quitting?
Well, it's not so much that made me say, I'm quitting. There was a point that made me say, my God, I've got to do that as opposed to what I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when I was in London, and I went to the National Theatre and saw a production of Jumpers by Tom Stoppard. And I remember that production starring Michael Hordern as if it were yesterday. It just sort of just ignited me, and I just was left limp at the end of it. And I thought, my God, I've got to do that. I've got to do that no matter what. I've got to do that. And if I can't do it, I've at least got to try to do it. And I just can't be 60, 65, 70 years old looking back on a life and saying, oh, my God, why didn't I do that? I came back to Chicago, and I went to see A View from the Bridge, and it was the same thing. And I don't know whether the production was that great or whether I was just so, by this time, burning with this intense desire that it was the same thing. And then I saw that they were offering classes at the St. Nicholas Theater, and I thought, okay, well, this is it. This is my chance. So I enrolled in an acting class at the St. Nicholas Theater, and at the same time quit my job because there was no time to rehearse with other actors or do anything if I were working. And looking back on it, it was madness. I mean, to give up a good, well-paying, prestigious job and embark on probably the most precarious career in existence, a career where at any given time 95% of the union is out of work, was just insanity.
When you started to act, and you were already, what, in your late 30s?
Yeah, 37.
Was it embarrassing or awkward being a mature man and being a novice as an actor? I don't know who the other people were, who you were acting with and who were taking classes with you. You might have been older than they were, less experienced than they were. It can make you very self-conscious.
It would in a situation where you weren't so happy. I mean, I was never self-conscious in that situation. I'll tell you when I was more self-conscious in a similar situation is when I started college.
When you were younger?
When I was younger, but I had been in the Army, and I'd emigrated. I'd gotten out of high school in England. I'd emigrated to the United States. I'd worked for a while. I'd been in the Army for 3 years, and so I was quite a bit older than the rest of my class. And I was constantly mistaken for a teacher as opposed to a fellow student. And I always felt a lot different. I don't know whether it was because of the maturity that came with being an ex-serviceman or whatever it was, but there was always a little uncomfortable quality there. But with acting, even though I was in class with people who, on average, were probably 15 years younger than I was, I never felt any self-consciousness at all because I was too consumed with the excitement and the thrill of doing this.
All the years that you weren't acting and you were editing this medical newsletter, did you use any acting skills in your life?
No, I didn't. I think I was storing up a lot of things that I have used since.
You weren't sitting at your desk impersonating people or just using in everyday life skills associated with acting.
No, I really wasn't, unless lying is part of that, you know. I mean, obviously, I'd have to lie to writers who couldn't write their way out of a paper bag and tell them how wonderful they were as I tried to make their stuff publishable. So maybe if good acting is good lying, then maybe I was doing that.
You grew up in England. What mm-hmm. happened to your English accent?
Well, I tried very hard to lose it. I immigrated to the States when I was 19, and I'm from the north of England. I'm not the sort of person who likes to stand out in a crowd, which might sound strange for an actor. I mean, I like to shine on the stage or in a film, but on one-on-one, I just like to be like everybody else. And even in those days, it used to drive me crazy when people would say, oh, I love the way you talk. Oh, isn't that wonderful? Or say this or say that or say banana or say, you know. And they were being nice, but it would drive me crazy. And so I set out to learn how to speak like an American. And I would ask people, I was in the Army at the time, and I'd ask people, how do you pronounce this? How do you say half? And they'd say half. And I'd say, how do you say banana? How banana? And I'd write them down, and I'd drill myself just like I was learning a foreign language. The only trouble was I was in the Army with people from all over the United States. So somebody from Nebraska would tell me how to say one thing, and somebody from Brooklyn would tell me how to say something else. So I had this horrible mongrel accent when I got out. But when I went to school in Quincy, Illinois, I went to Quincy College, and by the time I got out of Quincy, of course, it had pretty much settled into this Midwestern thing that I have now. But I tried very hard to lose it, and it was to fit in. As boring as that sounds, it was to be like everybody else. That's why I did it.
Actor John Mahoney is my guest. He's appeared in such films as Eight Men Out, Moonstruck, and Say Anything. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Actor John Mahoney is my guest. When you started acting in movies or on Broadway, did you feel that there was anything you had to fake because you weren't very experienced yet?
That's very interesting. I, not so much fake, but I was intimidated, I must admit. Being older than people didn't intimidate me, but being less experienced did. And I don't know whether that's why I rely so much on a director. I hate being left to my own devices when it comes to developing a character. And I relish a good, strong director. I love that. I was more intimidated by my lack of experience than anything else. In fact, I act a little differently than most of my fellow Steppenwolfians. I remember John Malkovich telling me, you know, you're the only person I know who speaks in sentences. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, when you say lines, you can see where the period comes. You can see where the capital letter starts. You can see where the paragraph ends. And I noticed when I watched other people in Steppenwolf work that it's true. They try very consciously to break things up to make it more conversational. But you see, conversational to me is sentences. I think I express myself well, and I don't know whether it's my education or my background or because my family did. I never did speak that broken way, so.
So it must
thought,
be hard
well,
for you to do Mammoth, then,
should
huh?
I try? Well, no, actually, David at least writes in sentences.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to think of what would be more difficult. When we did In a Nightingale Sang, it was a little difficult because, or to do something like Virginia Woolf would be a little difficult because mm-hmm. it's written with so many ellipses. But Mammoth, no. Even though there are a lot of short one-word sentences even, it's at least you know what he wants. Even like in this particular adaptation of Uncle Vanya, at one point I say, eat, sleep, drink. I'm talking about the way my life is now as opposed to working. All I seem to do now is eat, sleep, drink. They're all one-word sentences, according to David, I guess to stop you from doing that horrible thing that so many people do now. All I do is eat and sleep and drink, you know, that horrible way that people have learned how to talk from television. And I guess as a way to get around that, David very specifically made them sentences. And so it stops you from doing that, and it's great. I love it because I wouldn't do it anyway, and it's nice to know that I'm doing what David wants as well.
You said that you like to work with strong directors.
Mm-hmm.
In movies, some of the directors you've worked with are John Sayles, Costa Gavras, mm-hmm. Norman mm-hmm. Jewison, Cameron Crowe. Yeah. Give me a sense of something you've learned from working with a strong director.
I liked the directors you mentioned are all so different.
Mm-hmm.
Norman Jewison and Roman Polanski, for example, would be behind the camera, jumping up and down, laughing, crying, cheering you on silently to such a degree that it's almost distracting to you. John Sayles and Barry Levinson, on the other hand, will be behind the camera, and you have no idea whether they like what you're doing. You get to the end of a take for Norman or Roman, and they say, "Wonderful! Oh, great, great, great! That was wonderful." You get to the end of a take with John or Barry, and it's okay. Let's move on, or okay, new setup, and you say, "Well, how was it?" "Oh, it was good." "Well, just good?" You know. "Well, no, it was very good. It was very good. That's why we're moving on." They're just not. They're just not very demonstrative, and I like a little more structure. I like to be able to discuss something. I like to go up to, like, with Norman Jewison and Moonstruck and be able to say, "Norman, do you think this whole thing is a line that he's used before?" And Norman say, "Well, okay, well, let's sit down and talk about this." And then start to give me reasons, pro and con, and what his feelings are and how they should be played, as opposed to a director who will say, "Well, let's see, what do you think?" Or, you know, which drives me nuts. "Well, just do what you feel," you know, or something like that. It's such a It's just sloughing off responsibility, because I think a director should be there for you and should be there to help you through things, and that's what I mean by a strong director. I don't mean somebody who, Eric von Stroheim, or somebody who holds a whip and snaps it or something like that, or makes you jump through hoops, but I mean somebody who has very definite opinions, who's thought about this and who will give them to you and will help you, as opposed to somebody who might think that the sun rises and shines in you, and therefore you do whatever you want. I don't like that.
You know how you worked on your voice to get rid of your English accent?
Uh-huh.
When you started acting, did you do any work with your voice on enunciation? You have a beautiful voice and great enunciation.
You.
Yeah. I mean, not over-enunciation, but
yeah.
It's just really great. Did you work that up? Was it natural already?
That was pretty natural, yes. I'll tell you, I worked on the timbre of my voice. When I was doing Orphans, before we moved to New York,
mm-hmm.
I was going to be playing an alcoholic, and I wanted a rough quality in my voice that I didn't have. And so I worked very, very hard to get a gravelly quality to it. And my voice never quite recovered from that. And so it sounds a little different now than it did when I first started out, but it's to my advantage, actually, because I guess I have a much more distinctive voice now than I used to have, and people notice it and remember me by it, which I like very much. As far as enunciation, no, that just comes, I think, from possibly being born and raised in England, perhaps, or I just do tend to enunciate. In fact, to such a degree that I've had other actors tell me that I do it too much. I remember I was doing Born Yesterday at Steppenwolf, and Glenn Headley used to tell me, she played Billy, and I played Harry Brock, and she'd sometimes tell me, "You're hitting those final consonants much too hard. You know, people don't talk like that." And I said, "Well, Glenn, people do talk like that because I talk like that."
When you were working up the gravelly voice, what did you do?
I used to lock myself in closets, and I used to do very, very strenuous vocal warm-up exercises. And people didn't want to be in the same room as me. I made these horrible sounds. I mean, I started slowly, and I warmed my voice up before I started doing that. And as far as I know, knock on wood, I haven't hurt it or damaged it. But people do say, especially at the end of an evening when my voice is pretty much shot, or not at the end of an evening, but at the end of a two-show day, people get worried about it and say, "Are you all right? Is your voice okay? Is it?" And I say, oh, yeah, it's fine, no problem. It'll be back tomorrow just the same as... And it always is. It's always there just as strong as can be. But people the things that I did sound terrible. I know it shocked a lot of actors with the ferocity of my vocal warm-ups. Shocked a lot of people in New York.
What were you doing?
Well, I can't do it on the radio because, for one thing, it's much too loud. And for another thing, it's just much too ugly. You know, if I back way away from the microphone, I might be able to give you a little demonstration here. It's just something like...
Wow.
No, I don't know what you heard there, because I backed away quite a bit.
That's really something. So you'd lock yourself up in a closet and do that for a long time.
Well, it's not. I mean, and I wouldn't do it just right off the bat, just like I did then. Uh-huh. I'd do very gentle things first, you know, just sort of, things like that until, for a good half hour, I spend a lot of time warming my voice up so that I don't damage it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm very happy with the way it turned out, actually. I think it's gotten me a lot of work, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, well, you really have a wonderful voice.
Well, thanks.
You took a really big risk when you left writing and editing to work in acting. Once that risk like paid off, not only in terms of success but in terms of just fulfillment, did you find yourself taking other big risks in life that you wouldn't have dreamed of taking before?
I guess I did. I bought a house. That's a big risk. Let me think. What other risks are there, to tell you the truth? I really don't know what other risks I have, you know, that have been open to me. I don't think I'm afraid to do anything or go anywhere. I have a tremendous amount of confidence now in myself as a person, in myself as an actor, in myself as a successful person. And I think it has carried over into all aspects of my life. I'm not intimidated by anybody or any situation. If I look out at an audience when I was doing House of Blue Leaves and see George C. Scott out there or Jack Nicholson or Paul Newman or Henry Miller, Arthur Miller, I'm not intimidated by anybody whatsoever or any situation whatsoever. And I guess this has a lot to do with it. I guess the success that I made in the biggest challenge of my life had a lot to do with that.
Well, listen, thanks so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Actor John Mahoney, this is Fresh Air. Let's see what they're working on at All Things Considered. What's coming up, Robert?
Well, we'll be hearing about the demonstrations in New York City and Brooklyn outside the trial of the two men charged with the murder of a black youth in Bensonhurst, the Bensonhurst section of Brooklyn. Also, a talk with New York Daily News columnist Jack Newfield about the unusual number of racial conflicts that seem to be dominating the news out of New York City nowadays. We will be hearing about demonstrations for and against independence in the Soviet Republic of Estonia, and a talk with a man in Washington, Pennsylvania, who is an extra in the remake of Night of the Living Dead. You know what part he tried out for?
What?
Zombie.
Of course.
And he got it.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Sidney Zion is best known as a journalist, but he's also an attorney who's been both prosecutor and defender. Now Zion has written a novel called Markers. Book critic John Leonard says some of the subjects of Zion's previous writing figure strongly in the themes and plot of his novel.
The ghost of the late Roy Cohn haunts the pages of Markers, Sidney Zion's first novel. You may recall that of the two biographies of Cohn published a couple of years ago, Zion wrote the friendly one. Cohn may have been Joe McCarthy's truffle hunter, on the snort for pinkos in the State Department in the 1950s, and a pal of loudmouths like master builder Donald Trump and principal sports brat George Steinbrenner, and a mouthpiece for mobsters like Carmine Galante, and a fixer of judges in elections, a welsher on loans from his own clients, and a closet gay who spent his career in public bashing other gays until he died of AIDS in 1986. But Cohn was also a buddy of Zion's, always good for a journalistic scoop, and arranged a quickie liquor license for Zion's Manhattan Saloon. And so Zion, ordinarily a superb reporter for everybody from muckraking Scanlon's to the good gray New York Times, let his buddy Roy brag into a tape recorder, and wrote him up as a charming rogue. Charm is not enough in Markers, Zion's wise guy novel. The word Markers refers not exactly to debts of honor, but to unwritten IOUs in the underworld of wheeler dealers. I'm in trouble. I need something. You do me a favor. The fix is in. I owe you. You've got a marker on me. The bigger the favor, the bigger the marker. This is how it works in business, politics, and organized crime, which is all one world in Zion's novel, wormy to the core. The fix is always in, and the biggest fixer of them all is Jesse Frank, in whom you'll recognize quite a lot of Roy Cohn. Like Cohn, Jesse is a legal whiz who represents the mob, a jet-setter on a first-name basis with the bullies of the world, a pet of the gossip columnists. You want it, he'll fix it, and you owe him. Everybody owes Jesse except the newspaper columnist Mike O'Rourke, his college friend and adopted brother. For reasons we won't go into, O'Rourke's been raised by his Irish and Jewish families, fixers themselves, to be a righteous dude. These same families help Jesse make it in their own power broker world. There's inside stuff on Jersey politics, labor rackets, Meyer Lansky and the mob, Bobby Kennedy and the Justice Department, high rollers on Broadway and in real estate, bought judges and bought cops. There are also some terrific trial scenes, and three or four interesting women, most unusual in a wise guy novel, where women are supposed to be mothers who suffer, or bimbos who bounce. Why does Mike decide to bring down Jesse? Because Zion the novelist is rethinking what Zion the journalist let his buddy Roy Cohn get away with. Jesse, never mind how, is about to achieve the ultimate marker. The President of the United States will owe him. That's too much for Mike. Unless we count the love of parents for their children, Mike's drawing of this line is the single scruple in a long novel. For all the snap, crackle, and pop of its action and its dialogue, Markers is really a case history of corruption, a textbook on social Darwinian reptiles, all of whom listen to Frank Sinatra. George V. Higgins might have written it, or Joseph Wambau, or a wise guy Dante reporting back on an inferno of fixers and cynics. But it seems to me that Sidney Zion, like a hard-shelled crustacean at the bottom of a sea of secrets, is at last swimming toward the light.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine. He's also a columnist for New York Newsday and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Sidney Zion's novel, Markers. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Sherrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
That's the band Brave Combo. And on the next Fresh Air, they perform a concert of polkas and cha-chas, not to mention some oddball polka versions of old rock hits. Also, we talk with musician, composer, and actor John Lurie. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.